tonight on Arena. Alan Hollinghurst on his latest novel, Our Evenings, and film editor Ununi Kalinda on her recent work, including Paddington in Peru. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Back in 1988, Alan Hollinghurst's debut novel, The Swimming Pool Library, caused quite a stir in literary circles, capturing as it did the lives of affluent gay men. It was the beginning of a stellar career. It was followed by a Booker Prize winning, The Line of Beauty, which explored themes of privilege, hypocrisy and homosexuality in Thatcher's Britain, even giving us a dance-on cameo from the Iron Lady herself. More recently, his novels have looked at the course of a lifetime of individual gay men. His current book, Our Evenings, is a tender novel that explores ideas of race and class, love and loss through the life of a jobbing actor called David Wynne, who grew up in Britain knowing very little about his Burmese father. Delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Alan Hollinghurst. I suppose, Alan, in your fiction, perhaps in your real life as well, I don't know, but certainly in your fiction, you always seem to have been attracted by the outsider. But David Wynne is an outsider on many different counts, in fact, isn't he?
He is, yes. I have always liked that position of someone sending someone into a new kind of social world with their antennae twitching for everything that's different and interesting about it. And yes, David, well, he's a little bit older than me, born a few years before me. And like me, he turns out to be gay. But I thought I would send him through the times that I've lived through and through some of the worlds I've moved in myself. But with this further distinguishing difference of being mixed race and having a brown skin, very anomalous in the kind of conventional country world that he's born into in the late 1940s.
Yeah, he's in the home counties, essentially in what would have been very white middle class type of existence, where anybody of a different colour skin would certainly have been, I don't know if frowned upon is the right word, but they would have been othered, that's for sure.
They certainly would have been othered, yes. And I think his mother, Avril, who's had this brief liaison when working in as a secretary in Burma with a Burmese man that we never find out very much about, she has returned to this very conventional little community, pregnant, gives birth to a brown-faced child. So they're very much sort of on the margin. They are, again, they're outsiders in this world that they're inhabiting.
Was there something specifically about choosing a Burmese father in the writing of the novel that attracted you?
I think I've wanted for some time to try and write from a different racial perspective. And I saw that there were all kinds of hazards in doing so. And indeed, all these issues became much more prominent and politicized over the time that I was planning on writing the book. And I thought it would be impertinent of me to try and write, say, from the point of view of a second-generation Jamaican immigrant or something like that, because I will be speaking for a very large community of people who have, after all, quite an impressive literature of their own. So the Burmese thing, I thought, was very out of the way. It's a heritage which has very little kind of presence or imprint in British life. And I like the fact that it was something from the fringes of the end of the colonial world. Avril had been working in Burma for the governor during the lead-up to the Burmese independence in 1947. And she's brought back with her. I mean, I remember this so well in my childhood in the 1950s. You know, she brought back with her various little artifacts, teak boxes and fabrics and things from the East. And that was very much the world I grew up in. You know, people who'd been in India or Malaya and so on. So I think I was sort of partly digging into my childhood memories and thinking one could make something which was both tactful and unusual, interesting out of it.
Yeah, and in general terms, the idea of, you know, cultural appropriation is often the term that is used in these situations. In general terms, did you have anxieties around that? Do you agree with those ideas that, you know, you can't write about something that you aren't?
I don't agree with that, no. I mean, it seems to be rather a fundamental position for the creative writer, you know, that you use your imagination to enter into the lives of other people. That's really what I spent most of my professional life doing. But of course, I see the hazards of it. I mean, everything depends on how well it is done, how sensitively, it would be possible to do these things in a very sort of presumptuous and insulting way. But I was anxious, as over these years of when cultural appropriation became quite a hot topic, I did have some anxiety about it, but I wanted to do it, and I have. And generally, it seems to have found favour. Mm.
Looking at the way you tell his life, essentially, if I can put it this way, you tell his childhood in many ways and that early part of his life very slowly to us. It's in very small little sections that move quite gently into the next part, and then later on things start flying along as he gets older. I guess that may well be a reflection of how it feels at a certain stage in life.
Well, I hoped it had that effect partly, yes. The thing that when you get to my age, which is 70, you find yourself more and more sort of entering in memory into periods in the past, sometimes quite remote past, but you've very little idea what you did 3 weeks ago. You know? So that sense of time speeding up. The book's in two halves, and the first half is really all about David's education. So I wanted to sort of create that feeling of adolescence and young manhood when you're growing physically, you're growing inside in all sorts of almost indescribable ways, but your whole life is caught up in the slow moving structures of school terms and school years and everything, and you don't have much sense, any clear sense of what your future is going to be. And at the end of the first half of the book, which is when David leaves Oxford, he has a big sort of complicated crisis, and we rejoin him in the second half a few years later, and he's loose in the world, making his way as an actor. I hope that kind of wrong foots the reader,
yes,
a bit. There's a sudden change of tempo.
Yeah, there certainly is. Just before we leave the childhood section, I think it's important to mention, because I think it's an important aspect of things here, two things I want to talk about, in fact. Mark and Cara Hadlow, the benefactors, essentially, whose scholarship brings him to this very posh school, where he's even more like a fish out of water than he is in his local community. They're quite an interesting pair.
I'm glad you think so, yes. I mean, they're probably rather idealised in a way, but they're wealthy, sort of leftish cultural benefactors, philanthropists. The actual source of their wealth, I've kind of left rather mysterious. But Dave, of course, has grown up without a father and is at various points drawn to different father figures. And they are, in a way, very enabling to him. You know, they've enabled him to have this expensive education, which, as you say, is also rather disorienting for him in a lot of ways. But he's very clever, David, and it was important to me that he would be a sort of quick-witted person and a quick learner, you know, and a survivor. I didn't want to write a book about a victim. I wanted him to be someone who can sort of thrive and do his best. And I think, yes, and the Cara and Mark Hadlow, they recur at various points in his story and sort of help him through. And he sees them as a great benign presence in his life.
Yeah, they are kind of, there's something quite heroic about them in their altruism and in the way that they look after people, particularly in the area of arts and cultures. I don't know how many benefactors like that exist in contemporary society.
All too few.
I would have thought so. The other person who we must mention in terms of particularly the early childhood is his mother, Avril. And her, I'm going to say companion, and you might explain why I might, because I'm sure that's what she would have been called at the time, her companion, Esme Croft. Avril is a wonderful mother to David.
Yes, she is. I wanted it to be the book to be a portrait of the long relationship between a mother and her only child, her son. Yes, she's a person of great sort of quiet fortitude and determination and ingenuity. And of course, they've had this very close life together when David's at his little local primary school and their evenings are spent together. But then he goes off to boarding school and she's left alone in the evenings. When he comes home, he realizes that his mother works as a dressmaker. And although she's a bit of an outsider in this world, she also has this rather intimate access to a lot of the women in the town for whom she's making clothes and so on. And Dave finds when he comes home that Esme is taking up a larger and larger place in his mother's life. So that's the other sort of long-lasting relationship, yeah. I suppose, in the book, yes, which runs in parallel to his own.
And I guess that, whatever about being common, it would have been the way that a relationship would like that between Esme and Avril would have been handled at the time as their companions, their friends, people they would neither say what they were, nor would they deny what they were in terms of their physical and sexual relationship with each other.
I think that's absolutely right. And I clearly remember from my own childhood in the 50s and 60s, couples like this, two women who ran a little tea shop that we often went to, they were always referred to together. They were they and their names were sort of inseparable, you know. It's so hard, of course, to know what anybody imagined or assumed about these things in the past. Yeah. It certainly, of course, never crossed my mind when I was a boy. But later in life, when they sort of retired and bought a little bungalow, so it was perfectly clear to me then what was going on. So I wanted to, yes, recreate that. I mean, there's a lot that's unsaid in this book.
Yeah.
And Avril herself encourages this, or almost enforces this kind of regime in which all sorts of things simply cannot be talked about.
The fact that as we move into the second half of the book and we find David now as an actor and he has a number of close relationships with young actors, very close relationships, and eventually leading to a lifelong type of relationship with a man called Richard. What was it about the world of theatre and acting? I mean, I'm thinking of that particular period in British theatre, you know, the 70s and late 60s, early 70s, maybe even into the 80s, when there was a kind of almost an activism in theatre, certainly a very strong political edge to theatre. That seems to have been part of the story you're telling here as well.
I think it is, yes. I mean, he has this gift for acting, and I saw that as being part of his way of kind of adapting himself to his surroundings. But and he has great triumph in plays when he's at Oxford, and ought to be on the threshold of a wonderful career as an actor. But of course, someone who looks like him is not going to get any but the most sort of trivial and racially stereotyped roles in any theatre at the time. So he joins up with this sort of alternative touring theatre group, which I don't think there was one. I mean, there were quite a lot that were similar to it. Mm. And I think I wanted it to be a sort of space where there are people of different sexualities and I think an unusual mix of races and so on. And they're a little alternative bubble, yes, putting on these sort of politically disruptive productions of the classics, touring around and shocking people in the provinces with a lot of male nudity.
The other character that I should mention along the way here as well is a guy called Giles, who is the son, the obnoxious son, might I add, of Mark and Cara, who we mentioned earlier on, these benefactors who have been very supportive of David and many of his arts friends' activities as well. Giles turns out to be a Tory MP later on in life. How much did you enjoy making him into that particular type of person?
Yes, well, Giles is, yes, he's just, from the very beginning of the book to the end, he's a bully and a kind of obstacle to everything that Dave wants to do. And yes, well, of course, there was a grim kind of fun in it, in turning him into this sort of prominent Eurosceptic and one of the architects of Brexit and so forth. The kind of time span of the book is contained within the period when Britain was first trying to join the EU, and it ends just after the disastrous decision to leave it. So, Giles is the kind of monster. He's not a character that we kind of get into the inner life of at all. He's just a kind of recurrent obstacle.
That's your definition of the Tory MP, a recurrent obstacle in this novel. Finally, David, there is some of the most moving scenes in the book for me were in and around the deaths of Avril and Esme and the sense of loss that David has. You dedicate this book to your own mother who died. Was she 97 when she died, just before the writing of this book?
She was, yes.
And how did that fit? How do you think that fed into what you were writing here?
I'm sure it did in all sorts of incalculable ways. I mean, Avril's actual story is really very different from my mother's, and I don't think that. But they both have that thing of having grown up in the provinces, been in the war. They have that sort of resilience and toughness and wisdom to them, and people who were perhaps denied opportunities that they would have had if they'd been born later on. And yes, that bond between, as I was saying, between David and Avril was a sort of central thing. And the sense when she dies that he's losing not only her, but that whole world in which he grew up and in which a lot of the first part of the book has taken place is sort of he's saying goodbye to something larger than just his mother.
Yeah, well, I suppose you've put it on record on the pages of the book, and that's one way of holding on to it in some small way. Alan Hollinghurst, thank you so much for speaking with us on Arena this evening.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Alan Hollinghurst, and Alan's new novel is called Our Evenings. It is published by Picador. Now, when we talk about film and television dramas, there's a tendency to focus on the work of the writers, the actors and the directors involved. But the editor is the person who can make the finished piece sing. Dublin woman Una Ní Gonaille is one of the most sought after of those singer-type editors. She has edited films like Belfast, for which she was BAFTA nominated, Death on the Nile, Paddington in Peru, a very recent addition to her work, which is in cinemas right now, and The Young Woman and the Sea. Before that, she worked on TV series including The Crown and Three Girls, for which she won a BAFTA. At the moment, she's working with Kenneth Branagh once again on his latest feature, The Last Servants of Madeleine Hind, which stars Jodie Comer. And Tá Fáilte Is Fiche, Rev Una Ní Gonaille, the studio Loma Nocht. You were slagging me, Una, that we'd have to do the total interview Oscar-ilige because of your own Earscoil Nahi, Naka.
Earscoil Nahi, agus Clostisgan. So, Gurn Gilmahagat.
Yeah. And we'll come back to Irish language films a little bit later on, but let us talk about the role of the editor. People often talk about films in terms of, you know, there are three points at which the film can kind of be really shaped and moulded, and the final one of those is arguably the editing, in the editing room.
Correct. Yeah, that is what they say. They say the script takes life on the page. Second rewriting of the script is in the shooting. And then the third rewriting is in the editing. Because when you do write a script, no doubt whenever you begin to shoot, time could go against you. So I begin on the first day of principal photography, and sometimes even before then, I could collaborate with the director. Depending on the director, they may share the script with me at an early stage and we discuss. So from the first day of principal photography, if you can imagine shooting with 500 people on set, the sun has gone down, rain has come, you have to work on your feet and you could drop shots or drop scenes. And that's my role, really, that I get all the material that they've shot. The director may feel like they need to shoot more, or they had to get rid of a scene owing to time. So I very quickly cut it together and I can either confirm, yes, maybe we need X, Y and Z, or I could give solace and say, don't worry, it looks really beautiful. And if we play it through this perspective, it could work. And I would send that back to them. So it's a communication. Yes. That's during the shoot now. And then it continues thereafter when we're in the cutting room.
In the editing room itself. But I guess there have been situations, and I'm sure you have had them, where the director is saying to you, we're missing a whole big chunk.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, I remember something that happened on day 57, which has nothing got to do in some ways
correct.
With this scene that we shot on day four.
Yeah, and that happens all the time. And
can you give us a specific example of how something like that has solved a huge problem?
Say, for example, I've got two very good examples, but I'll go for the latest one. In Young Woman in the Sea, because they shot against blue screen.
Just explain the film, the idea behind The Young Woman in the Sea. It's a true story, based on a true story.
It's based on a true story. So it's on Disney Plus, should anyone have Disney Plus. It's a beautiful story produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, and Jeff Nathanson wrote, based on a book by Glenn Stout called Young Woman in the Sea, which I recommend to anyone if you're looking for Christmas presents. It's about Trudy Ederle, and 100 years ago, she became the first woman to swim the English Channel. And she did it at a time when society did not want women to swim. They said it was unfeminine and that it would make us, you know, lack fertility and give us an athletic shape. So it was very frowned upon. And she broke through those conventions. And with the love and support of her family, she actually tried this thing. She was championed by her father and mother. And even her own coach tried to drug her when he realised she was beating all the male records. So the truth of this woman's story is she broke all the records, and she was celebrated at that moment in her life in 1926. But now she's been removed from the history books. And we were very interested in giving her her rightful place back in history as being the fastest person, regardless of gender, to swim the English Channel at that time. And she was a wonderful person, Trudy Ederle, a German migrant living in New York.
And played in the film
by Daisy Ridley, who's extraordinary. And Daisy had sort of a fear of the open water, and then she even championed herself to train for 3 months prior to shooting so that she would actually swim. So we shot it in Bulgaria, and if anyone watches it, it's shot in the open water, which again is very unusual. Very often studios would use tanks, and that's Daisy out there actually swimming with blue lips. I was watching all the material, and it was wonderful. It gave it an authenticity.
And I guess you were talking about this idea where you might find something in one
correct
shoot. Yeah.
So we had to shorten that film, we had to collapse some scenes, and Disney were thinking that we should have a little moment of sort of like a Cinderella moment when all her dreams are failing her and she feels like the world is going to dictate that she cannot swim. And we didn't have the footage. So my director, Joachim Ronin, was thinking he might have to shoot. They didn't necessarily have the budget to shoot. And I remembered that there's another scene that we had when she was on the boat, all shot against a blue screen, where we would paint in the background of the ocean. So I very quickly realised if I could repurpose that and paint in the background of Coney Island, we could use that material. So I said to Joachim, I have an idea to try out. And he said, OK, let's audition that idea. And I did it with the help of my VFX editor. He put in the background for me. I cut it and then he painted in Coney Island, and we presented it to Disney, and they were thrilled because that's what you'll see if you watch the movie after the Olympic failure, her failure at the Olympics.
Yeah.
That little sequence was just repurposed material that we had in the film for bigger scenes that had fallen out of the film.
I wondered in the case, I think you had a similar type of telescoping moment for different reasons in Paddington in Peru recently, and thanks be to God you did have it, because it gives us a wonderful moment with Olivia Colman.
yes, and that is the necessity of when the film is too long, because every film, no doubt, when you put it together, you find it's a little bit too long. So the challenge in editorial, it's about storytelling. That's what I would say to anyone who's listening. I'm very blessed that I come from a beautiful family. I have a lovely mom and dad and my brothers and sister. And growing up, they always had great parties. They're teetotal pioneers, non-smokers, but the best parties. And they would sing. My grandparents were the same. So I grew up with a family who were very good oral storytellers. And I find that my editing, I would attribute that from them, that I have taken that on. And even when Dad did a bedtime story, for example, about the golden leg, if anyone knows that story, Mom would stay at the light, and when there was the punchline of "you did it," Mom would turn off the light and Dad would grab all of us and we'd all be screaming. So that visceral storytelling, I try and bring into my editing. And with Paddington in Peru, it was a little bit long, and the question was, how can we get to Peru faster? And we had this magnificent song by the Reverend Mother, and then we had a musical journey to Peru, and just that idea of, well, what if we collapse those two scenes together and we use Olivia Colman's song as our tool to get us to Peru?
Presto.
So I tried that out, and then Dougal loved it. Then Dougal Wilson, my director, he added a few more bongos and a few little extra details. So it's like each person inspires the other to keep trying to forensically investigate the story and see if you shake it, what else could reveal itself. And if you reinterrogate the material, you can find something very truthful.
Yeah, because I guess there is always that that idea, you know, you often speak about it in radio. If you don't have it, you're not going to be able to use it. Whereas if you've recorded it, you might need it, that's fine, but it's there in the background. But then I guess you have to avoid the temptation of saying, oh no, let's just take another little version of that scene from this side, because you don't have the time to do this. So you have to be quite economic in the choices when you say, I think we need something to cover a possible problem here.
Correct, yeah. I think you have to always be working very quickly. And I trained on film, actual film. And I think that has given me a very good discipline that when I make a choice, I really do think about it. I could do some of my best editing cycling to work because I'm thinking about how I could make this scene work. So when you come into it, you do have to be very, very confident in knowing what the story is about. And then that can guide you. If you try and do 15 options of the same thing, or not 15 options of the same thing, but different variations of the same thing, you might lose your way. And that's where I do try and keep. But for Paddington, though, I was on it quite long. I was on it from March 2023. And we just finished the mix on like the 8th of October 2024.
And without spoiling it on anybody, and any younger listener, I'm thinking of particular here. When Ben Whishaw is there as Paddington, is he there for some of it, or do we have the little version of the version that we see, the live motion feature that we see, the person that our object that we see on screen? How does that work?
So yeah, if there are any little children listening, I would say that Paddington gets very, very tired. So what we do when we're shooting such a long day of, you know, 12, 14 hour days, there's a brilliant actor actually called Lauren Barrant, and she is a little person. She's in her 30s. She's a brilliant actress and our actor and very comedic. And the first setup of every take, Lauren stars as Paddington, and she wears his coat and his hat, and she's the right height. So it means that Hugh Bonneville and all the family, they have Lauren as a
an eyeline, and they can actually act opposite her.
Correct. And even better than eyeline, because she's actually an actor in her own right, she delivers. She says all Paddington's lines. So they're actually interacting in a very organic way. So as an editor, I always watch that take. Now, for the audience, they may have, say, if it's one setup, like a wide shot, they may do 15 versions of that. So Lauren's in the first one, and then thereafter, there's either a reference point or an empty space. And then, so, but every take has, at least the first one has Lauren in as a reference.
And does Ben Whishaw, is his voice used in certain takes? Or
he actually comes later. So comes later during the process of editing. Ben must have recorded, I'd say, about 13 different sessions where he added his voice in.
Yeah.
So very quickly I can have Ben's voice, and his performance is so beautiful. And because he's done it before, he knows Paddington, so he can do all the little grunts and things. But it's a collaborative with Ben, Lauren, Pablo, who actually creates Paddington. And when we're editing, you have to hold your nerve, because Dougal and I may have cut to a shot of Paddington, and at the moment, it's only an empty frame with maybe a one-dimensional cartoon image. So we have to hold our nerve when we're showing it to test audience screenings to know when he comes alive. He just steals the scene.
You were talking about the young woman in the sea earlier on, and how it was frowned upon that a woman might be thinking about swimming the channel or such awful things.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't she not? Why would she not be at home doing what might have been considered was her job at the time, etc.?
Yeah.
What about the role, particularly of the editor, but of the woman's role in general within the film work? Did you find you had, did you have to push hard to get yourself, you know, considered in the right way, in the same way as anybody who wanted to edit?
I think most women in the film industry would say we probably do have to work harder to be seen. And the visibility is very, very important. I've worked really hard. I've got a beautiful husband and children. So I have to say hi to Julian, Danny, Naomi and my godson, Andy. And they help me, because obviously with work, I can do a lot of the work from home during the shoot. But once the shoot is finished, I have to commute to London. So I have been working my socks off, really, because I love my job. I love the challenge. I am a bit like Trudy, that I don't like being pigeonholed. So I've done documentaries, thrillers, comedies. I did Doctor Who, I did Paddington. I'm constantly trying to push to make sure that I could do, you know, a big budget action movie. But you do have to constantly push and prove that you can do that. And I believe any of us can do it. And I think if anyone does watch Young Woman and the Sea, I feel what I love about that film and why I wanted to do it, it should be an inspirational story to anyone. Follow your dream, no matter what it might be, and don't let anyone tell you you can't do it.
One other thing I wanted to ask you briefly about, I could talk to you for ages, but let us go out on this. One of my favourite moments in Belfast, which is one of several movies that you have worked on with Kenneth Branagh, the opening sequence when we're in colour and then it shifts to black and white. But there are a couple of moments in the black and white, which is the majority of the film.
Yeah.
There are a couple of moments when things are in colour, one of which is the reflection in Judi Dench's glasses of, yes, of something of this. They're watching a film on screen,
yeah, yeah,
and the reflection is in colour. I believe that was your idea.
Yes, that was my idea. I said, what's brilliant about someone like Ken is he's such a great man and he is so confident in himself that he's very open to ideas.
Other people's ideas.
Exactly. Yeah. So then when we work together, I would always say, I feel like Paddington is a story about a migrant, really, about what constitutes home. And Belfast was the same thing, of just this father having to move to England for work. And I said to Ken, because that's my life experience with my career at the moment, I did feel a great empathy with that. So when I did see the granny, the role of the granny, and then when she is watching that, I just happened to suggest it. And Matt Glenn, my VFX editor as well, we were both talking to each other about how we could show this and do it and show Ken, and he loved it and he kept it and he did. He gave me credit for that.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched on the type of success you've had in television, but it sounds as if film is where it's at for you for the foreseeable, isn't it?
Well, you know what? I love TV as well. I would like, film is where it's at currently, but I would like to do TV as well. I think there's something joyful in doing TV where you work and it's on telly and people have the water cooler moment.
Yeah.
With films, sometimes you have to wait an entire year before it's seen. And then I'm hoping people go to the cinema and that they enjoy Paddington and Prue if they see it.
Paddington, Prue,
and Young Woman in the Sea.
Come home and watch Young Woman in the Sea.
yeah, have a bonanza.
If your child feels they're a little old for Paddington, they might your children might say, oh yeah, lad, watch the Young Woman in the Sea. Una garhana jasveg lower chlet.
Thanks. Garmil Mahagat.
Garmil Mahagat, this chock thing. That's Una Nicanila. Paddington in Peru, in cinemas right now. The Young Woman in the Sea is available to watch on Disney+. The RTE Short Story Competition 2024, in honour of Frances McManus, highlights the extraordinary talent of Irish writers. 10 stories selected from nearly 1,500 submissions. The 10 stories on this year's shortlist will be broadcast on RTE Radio 1's late date, starting tonight, leading up to an awards event at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire on Friday, the 29th of November, where the winner will be announced. We'll be there ourselves doing just that. Judges Neil Hegarty, Claire Kilroy and Kathleen McMahon carefully curated the shortlist. 10 shortlisted stories are Artifice by Sharon Gard, Chambermaid by Fiona O'Connor, Dead Bait by Matty Brennan, Desi and Hopper by Susanna Stitch, Divination by Stephen O'Reilly, Once Upon an Algorithm by Ryan Delaney, Planning the Leftovers by Sheila Barrett, The Other Orla by Emer O'Toole, The Rehearsal by Alexis MacIsaac, and Turncoat by David Ralph. Congratulations to all 10. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome the first of our shortlisted writers to discuss their stories. With me in studio is Sheila Barrett, and Matty Brennan is joining us on the line. Sheila's story is called Planning the Leftovers, and Matty's story is called Dead Bait. When you hear that, Sheila, sitting directly opposite me here, out of more than 1,500 entries, that you are one of these 10 shortlisted writers, it must be a pretty good feeling.
Well, it certainly was. It was great.
And when you got the phone call, I presume, from Sarah Binchy saying we're going to have your story, did you know who was going to read it? Because that's one of the things that happens with the shortlisted stories.
I didn't. And when I found out it was Breedon Necton, I was delighted. You know, it's really something to have your work read by somebody who's that professional.
Yes, yeah, to get that quality to it, and it does add something to the story. Have you heard much of that reading as of yet?
No, I haven't heard any of it yet.
Well, we are going to change that right now. But before we listen to the clip, well, this is actually the opening section of the story. So that will be what readers will get when they read the story. So the listener is going to get the same thing now. The opening section of Sheila Barrett's story, which is called "Planning the Leftovers."
The fire set in the sitting room. Gerard heads towards the kitchen, holding his smutty hands out in front of him. Fiona's own hands are clenched together at her breast. Gerard gives her a quelling look as he passes her. He'll turn up. The plane from Chicago landed at 9. It's almost 11. Gerard could be right. Sometimes he is. Just not ever about Kevin. Fiona wouldn't mind if she felt Chicago was going well for Kevin, but she hasn't had that feeling for a single day. He'll find his feet, is Gerard's mantra. Has been all along. Give him time. Construction's good for him. Harden him up a bit. He needs it, Fiona. When she and Gerard get on, he calls her Fee. There have been many Fionas the past few days. She was shattered when Gerard actually bought Kevin's ticket, bought it and handed him the cash to leave. Give him credit, Fiona. He had enough money for 2 months. He's lasted nearly 2 years. This unending morning, Gerard refuses to phone Kevin or Aer Lingus to see if he was even on the plane. He'll turn up. He's an adult. Fiona certainly hopes that Kevin, 24, is now an adult. She hopes he isn't nervous of the dark anymore, or inclined towards anorexia anymore, or inclined towards drink anymore. She's done her bit for this day anyway. The food is in, ready for the dinner, postponed from Christmas to St. Stephen's Day. The bed is made, the room aired.
And that is Breedon Yachtan reading from Sheila Barrett's story, Planning the Leftovers, one of the 10 shortlisted stories in this year's RTE short story competition. So there you have, you have heard that for the first time, Sheila, the sound of Breedon Yachtan's voice reading the story for you. It goes on to tell the story of this son, Kevin, coming home with a little surprise package for everybody. I don't know how much of that you want to give away or hold off. But when you hear the story read like that, I've often heard this from writers before, the story becomes alive in a different way from as it was on the page or even as you heard it.
Yes, it really does. And I particularly love to hear her reading it because of her Irish voice. And I just felt it needed that so much. I didn't want to read it myself because I thought it would throw the listener, really.
Yeah, and well, it is one of the great things that happens in this situation that it is a professional actor who comes in to read it. And let me bring in Matty Brennan at this point in time. Your story, Matty, congratulations on your shortlisting as well. Your story is called Dead Bait. I believe it turned out that you had written off to Santa Claus for an actor to read your story, and it turned out that Santa Claus got your letter, and you were on the good list, not the naughty list.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much, Sean. Yeah, I suppose it's adding to the whole surreal nature of it. I was joking with one of my friends when I got when I saw the shortlist, and I was told I was on it, and I was told that a professional actor would be reading it out. I joked that, like, yeah, they'll probably get someone like Aaron Monaghan, but never in my wildest dreams did I actually think he would be reading it. But yeah, and then I saw that he was, so just it adds the whole surreal nature of it, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, and it was indeed, as you say, Aaron Monaghan who's reading. We'll hear a red section from it shortly indeed. But we need to get a little bit of a sense of the setup in your story. In the Kiss of Sheila's, we had the opening section. This is a little bit further in to your story. But it was inspired, I think, you're based in Clare, Matty, and it was inspired by spotting a couple of fellas on the pier down at Doolin late at night.
It was, yeah. I mean, that's where the initial idea came from. Now, like a lot of stories, you know, it changed over time, and there's different iterations of this story, different versions. But yeah, I just one night I spotted a few men fishing at around 2 o'clock in the morning. Now, that is where the idea came from. But in my mind, I had just another pier. It could be any pier anywhere along the coast of Ireland. Yeah. And I left it sort of deliberately vague. I left the setting deliberately vague. But yeah, that's where the initial idea came from.
Yeah, and our unnamed narrator here is in a situation where he's finding himself involved in some not very dodgy, to say the very least, activity. And in the process of doing so, he's around some fairly difficult people who don't like when things don't go their way. The real coup de grace for me in many ways in the story is it suddenly shifts when Matty is driving off from the pier, or not Matty, the character narrator is driving off from the pier that night, having had the dealings with the two fairly rum characters who are involved in nefarious activity, as I say. And we listen to Erin Monaghan now, a very quiet type of reading of that journey away from the pier and what happens to the narrator next.
I see a gleam of light up ahead, near the turn for the main road. My stomach lurches till I realise it isn't neon blue. It's a vertical stream of pale light, as if someone is shining a powerful torch up to the sky. I slow down, hunch forward, and squint. As I near it, I can make out the shape of a small yellow car. A Fiesta. But it's all wrong. It's on its side. A mess in the ditch. One headlight is shining upwards. The other is smashed in. I lower the window. There's no sound from its engine. I'm at crawling pace now, inching past the wreckage, when I hear a faint cry. Unconsciously, I brake hard, shift into neutral and pull up the handbrake. A hoarse, frail voice is calling out. Help.
And that is Erin Monaghan reading from Matty Brennan's story, Dead Bait. And that really, that level of tension that I feel Erin gets into the reading of the story, he reads it at that very quiet but yet tense level of vocal delivery throughout. It really is, but he couldn't read it like that if it wasn't there on the page to start out with, Matty. I'm guessing tension was something that was important to you within the writing of this story, maintaining that.
Yeah, maintaining the tension was important. I think with this story in particular, and with stories of this length, with there's a word limit with the RTE short story competition, yeah. and it can sometimes people think it's restrictive, but it can also kind of force the writer to be economical. You know, so you're relying on the reader or the listener to sort of do a lot of the work, you know? So I think the tension, I try to create the tension by taking out some information, if that makes sense, and to leave just vital bits of information in.
Yeah, so as you paired it back, and I guess it's a bit like a sculpture, at least with a piece of writing, you can put the sentence back in. If you knock a bit of stone off, it's gone. You can't stick it back on. But I guess it was a process of kind of working out what bits needed to stay and what bits needed to go. I was saying, Sheila, to Matty there about it was this moment at the pier in Doolin which sparked off the story. Now, the story goes in a totally new direction. I think you have some things in your own background which feed into the story that you tell in planning The Leftovers, in that we have a young wife coming, a new wife coming into a well-established family. You had a similar experience, I think, yourself as a young woman, even though this is not the story that you're telling in planning The Leftovers.
No, and I was thinking about it because the story just seemed to come along pretty well on its own steam. And I could sort of envisage these people and hear them. And the thing that would be like my experience would be that I came into an established family from America. And, you know, it was great luck, you know, for me that it was the kind of family it was. Everybody had been somewhere, so that and you know, so that I wasn't a complete shock to them and so on. But the whole thing was just very interesting. I was very lucky in my mother-in-law, I must say, because she was a superbly kind of tolerant woman. You know, she didn't, she just sort of, we just sort of worked along over the years, and that was great.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that the young woman who comes into this family is going to be as lucky as that. I think the mother in the case of your story, what is her name, Fiona, is a little bit more difficult. Will be a little bit more difficult to deal with than that. Although the short story doesn't get to that point.
I must say, I have great hopes for Fiona.
It's interesting because I did think there is a further story to come potentially within planning The Leftovers. Do you have any sense that it could grow into something bigger than a short story or longer than a short story?
Perhaps not this particular family, because I'd really like to know more about Layla's background back in America. But so this will probably just bide and simmer, and you hope the best for them, you know. But I felt it was I think it's a story of giving and getting and giving in a way, losing and gaining, because gaining, you know, a happy grown child is worth anything, you know.
And in your terms, similar in many ways, Matty, I don't think you can really, I'm not sure if you can revisit these characters in any way, but your narrator here is a very interesting man who clearly has had a colourful life, and I'd like to know more about him.
I think a few of my friends and stuff have read it since it's gone up online and have said, you know, what happens to him? But I think... that's, as I said before, it's trust in the reader, and that they are able to complete the story for themselves, you know.
Well, listen, congratulations to both of you, and thanks so much for being with us this evening. That's RTÉ Short Story finalists Sheila Barrett and Matty Brennan. Sheila's story, Planning the Leftovers, will be read in full by Brigid Nocton, late date tonight at 11:20 p.m. You can hear Matty's story, Deadbeat, read in full again by Erin Monaghan tomorrow night, Tuesday the 19th of November, also at 11:20 p.m. All 10 short stories are available to read on rte.ie/culture, and every night from tonight you can hear the stories on late date on RTÉ Radio 1. Tickets for the Arena Special Awards night at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary on Friday the 29th of November are available at pavilion.ie. Now, before I finish up this evening, I did want to pay a tribute, which tributes have been coming in all weekend, of course, to John Kenny, the wonderful actor who died on Friday evening. The worlds of stage and screen, big and small, are mourning the loss of one of our greatest entertainers, very skilled performer indeed. With Pat Short and Don Believables, he captured the heart and the joy of rural characters in Irish life with an unmatched observational eye in stand-up, in theatre, in film, and latterly in poetry. John Kenny's legacy is rich and beloved. From One Hell of a Do to The Telly, from John B. Keane's The Matchmaker to Father Ted's A Song for Europe, from animated movie Song of the Sea to the celebrated Banshees of Inisherin, the range and beauty of John Kenny's work is one hell of a legacy, as he might have said himself. I'm going to leave you this evening with something from John Kenny, but before we do, let me tell you that tonight's programme was researched by Leah Murphy, the broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, Harry Buchlis was on sound, and the programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Going to leave you with an example of the genius of John Kenny. This is an extract from the wonderful tale that is Bridie's Christening.
Well, you know a Bridie, you do. Well, like, she'd be a sister of mine, Bridie. Like, Bridie's the one that had the mobile home down in Clare. Well, last weekend we were down at Bridie's, like, well, you see, well, Bridie was having a christening, like, you know what I mean? There's a fair turnout, there must have been about 30 or 40 or 50 at the christening, you know what I mean? And you know the way you'll be with about 30 or 40 or 50 people coming out of a christening, like, straight into a pub. And you know the way you'll be after coming from a christening, after stopping off in a pub, like, about 30 or 40, 50 people in one shot. You couldn't get a drink. I couldn't get a drink. So when I gets up to the counter, then I ask for a crate of Guinness, like, you know what I mean? Well, just to keep me going, like, you have me, like, you know what I mean? So I grabbed the crate of Guinness and I went straight down and I was drinking away nicely now, and I'd most of the crate of Guinness drank when who arrives in on the Bridie. Now, lads, ye know Bridie as well as I do, right? Typical Bridie, of course, you know what I mean? Are you staying here all day? Or what are you doing, says she. Right, says I, I'm going immediately. Well, you know the way you'll be after coming from a Christian, after stopping off in a pub, after drinking a crate of Guinness, going back to Bridie's, like, you know what I mean? Well, you'll see, Bridie was having a kind of a two-in-one. Bridie was having the housewarming and the Christian all in the one day, do you know what I mean? Right, says I, I'm going immediately. Well, you know the way you'll be after coming from a Christian, after stopping off in a pub, after drinking a crate of Guinness, going back to a housewarming, do you know what I mean, after coming from a Christian? Well, you couldn't be going back with one hand as long as another, like, you know what I mean? So I got another crate of Guinness and a large bottle of Paddy and straight back to the bungalow with me. Well, fickin' let you had the bungalow looking lovely, huh? Oh, Jesus, my lord. Aluminium doors, aluminium floors, aluminium gutters, aluminium shoes, aluminium downpipes, aluminium uppipes, aluminium Georgian pillows, aluminium windows. Fick, it was looking lovely now, like, you know what I mean? And I went straight into the middle room. You know the way you'd be inclined to go into the middle room inside in the house warming after coming from a Christian, after stopping off in the pub after drinking the Christmas? I was mad for the bit of crack, like, so I went straight into the middle room. And I was drinking away nicely inside, and I'd most of the sitting crate of Guinness drank, and a half a bottle of Paddy inside me, and I was kind of leaning against the mantelpiece. You know the way you'd be inclined to kind of lean against the mantelpiece with two crates of Guinness and a half bottle of whiskey inside you, like, when who arrives in on a Bridie? Jesus, says Bridie to me, Jack, will you mind just lighting? Says I, I'm fine. Well, you know the way you'll be with two crates of Guinness and a half bottle of whiskey inside you, like, will you give over? You're going to knock the whole place down. I won't, says I, I'm fine. And I get in pure tick with the drink with the two crates of Guinness and a half bottle of whiskey inside me at an angle of 45 degrees to the floor. Do you know what I mean? Defying the law of gravity, and I gathered up all the figurines at one end of the mantelpiece. Unknowns to myself. Jesus, will you mind? You're going to bring the whole lot down. I won't, says I, I'm fine. Well, lads, whatever move I make, everything that was on top of the mantelpiece came straight down onto the floor. And where did I end up? But inside in the fucking fire. Jesus Christ! Will you get out, says she, you're going to burn. I won't, says I, I'm fine. And I get in pure tick with the drink again. Will you get out, you're going to burn today. I won't, says I, I'm fine. And I get in pure tick with the drink with the two crates of Guinness and a half bottle of whiskey inside me. Well, that's whatever move I made. I rolled out of the floor on top of the new carpet. Well, if the shit didn't hit the fan, it was all awkward.